Hello, and welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. By harnessing cutting-edge technology, genetic testing offers a glimpse into our unique genetic variations, predispositions to certain health conditions, and responses to specific medical treatments. It opens doors to tailored interventions and preventative measures, guiding us towards a future of truly personalized healthcare. Genetic counselors empower individuals and families to navigate the complexities of their genetic makeup. Through personalized guidance and support, genetic counselors provide invaluable insights into inherited conditions, unraveling the genetic mysteries that shape our lives. Joining us today to help us decipher the secrets encoded in our DNA is Mr. Daniel Luxick, a genetic counselor and medical science liaison at Myriad Genetics. He worked at the Genome Science Department at University of Washington prior to earning his master's degree and entering the field of genetic counseling. Also joining us is Ms. Kira Dineen, a licensed certified genetic counselor who also earned a master's of science in human genetics and works in the prenatal space. She is the host and producer of DNA Today, a genetics podcast, which is in the top 1% of podcasts globally. Mr. Luxick and Ms. Dineen, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me and Dan on. We're excited to be here.
Me too. I'm so excited to talk about this. And we would love for you, listeners, to join our conversation. How can genetic counseling transform your health journey? How does genetic counseling provide personalized insights into inherited conditions? Call us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752, in Anchorage at 907-550-8433, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. So thank you both again for joining me. And as I prepared for this program today, I realized this field of genetic testing, genetic counseling is vast and ever evolving. So it seems like an exciting field to be a part of. So I'd love for each of you to just further introduce yourselves and tell us where you're joining us from today, exactly what you do and what led to your interest in this field. Let's start with you, Mr. Luxick.
Thank you. So my name is Daniel Luxick. I'm joining today from Portland, Oregon. I'm a genetic counselor, and a genetic counselor is basically somebody who's involved in the ordering or interpretation of genetic tests in a medical setting. I've been interested in genetics ever since I was young. I've got an identical twin brother, so my whole life I've actually sort of been thinking at least a little bit about how genes make us similar and different from each other.
Interesting. Okay, so you have your genetic makeup twin next to you. And yeah, I would be interested in that. Everyone's fascinated by twins.
It makes comparisons about, you know, the genetic effects of things pretty apparent when there's a copy of you genetically standing right there.
Right. And then in your daily life, tell me what you're doing as a genetic counselor.
Yeah, so I work as a medical science liaison at Myriad Genetics. So basically, my job is to be a clinical support person for the doctors and other medical providers who use Myriad's genetic tests. I work in the field of cancer testing. We'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. But I also cover some of our prenatal products as well.
Okay, excellent. And Ms. Dineen, you're no stranger to radio and airwaves and podcasting. I've actually listened to your program. It is so informative. And you've been doing this for over a decade, educating listeners on the field of genetics. So tell us more about yourself and your day job.
Yeah, so similar to Dan, I also trained as a genetic counselor. We're from the same program. And so I've been interested in genetics, maybe not as long as Dan, because I unfortunately do not have a twin. So I don't have like a cool genetics fun fact about me. But I have found it to be interesting as soon as I was really introduced to the concept in, you know, late middle school, early high school. And in high school is when I started DNA Today, as you mentioned, a genetics podcast. So it's kind of a way for me to learn more about the field. And over the last 10 years, you know, I've gotten a couple of genetic degrees and have been less learning and more interviewing and bringing on fellow experts. So it's been a really fun way to give back to the field and the community and everything. And as you mentioned, I also work as a genetic counselor in the prenatal setting. So I work in a high-risk pregnancy center. So mostly meeting with patients that are already pregnant and helping them navigate that pregnancy and learning about the genetics of their pregnancy and if there are any conditions that we should be suspicious for or that we need to talk through because there's been screening that's identifying like a high chance for a condition or if a condition's been diagnosed. So kind of giving a preview of everything we'll talk about today.
That's right. Well, starting a podcast whilst in high school, wow, I did not realize you were so young. What led to you starting that? And that seems like a pretty daunting task.
Yeah. So, I mean, 10 years ago, a lot of people didn't know this was before Serial, the podcast, came out. I think that's, you know, around 2014, people started knowing what a podcast was. So I used to have to say it's like an internet radio show, which is like what we're doing right now. Yep. But yeah, I think for me, it was a way of having people actually meet with me. Most people in high school, like if you reach out to geneticists and researchers and genetic counselors, they're going to be like, oh, you're in high school, like circle back when you're a little bit further in your educational career. So it was kind of a selfish move at the beginning, but it's really been a great way to just learn for myself. And then having my audience grow and learn along with me has just been a really cool experience and a long project, I guess, at this point.
How long do you see yourself doing this podcast?
Oh, forever.
Good.
Until I have to retire, let's put it that way. So I'll be in my 80s, like, doing this podcast.
Well, I guess the field is always changing, so there's always new information to bring. And just thinking about when I started, you know, looking into genetics till now, I'm amazed and continually learning, so... Okay, well, why don't you all give us a genetics lesson? Like, what are we talking about when we're talking about genetics and DNA and testing and counseling? What is that? Tell us about our genes.
Yeah, I can go ahead and jump in here. So genes, the easiest way to think about them are just our body's instructions for how to grow and how to function. So some things like our eye color or our hair color is affected by genes. Genes can also do a lot of other things that are important to our health, like protecting us from cancer or just developing our body in other ways. Sometimes people are born with a change in their genes that cause them not to work correctly. So we would call that a genetic mutation. And depending on what type of mutation and what gene you have, you can have any given disease or a risk of other diseases. So basically in the world of medical genetics, we're looking at all of the different ways that changes in our genes can affect our risks of getting certain diseases. And there's different ways we can look through those, different times that we would want to do a test on a patient, and lots of different information that we can get from those tests.
Excellent, excellent. Well, I started to make a list of all of the ways that genetic testing is used today, and the list is never ending. So I started with the very popular ancestry testing that we do online, and then I thought about the hereditary cancer screenings. I have experience with that, and ended with mental health treatments because I had heard about tailoring the treatments that would help you with your mental health using genetics. So can you walk us through all of the different ways? Because I've only named three, and I'm sure there's so many more.
Yeah, I can start us out. So I think you already covered so many there. A lot of people are familiar with 23andMe, Ancestry, MyHeritage. I mean, there's so many of these where you spit in a container, you send it off, and that lab will look at your genetics and give you a little information about that. And so that's kind of how a lot of people started learning about sequencing, as Dan was kind of alluding to earlier, of looking at reading through and writing out the genes and understanding the order of those letters and what that means. But in terms of how we use it, I think the cancer space, the prenatal space, pediatrics too. So, you know, looking at lots of different conditions that can be diagnosed from this, but also, as you mentioned, Dr. Woodruff, that we can look to see if people are predisposed to react to a medication in a certain way, if that person would need a higher dose or lower dose, if someone should just be prescribed a different medication altogether. So, you know, that's pharmacogenomics or pharmacogenetics. And there's just, I think it's almost easier to say what areas of healthcare are not influenced or affected by looking at genetics, which is kind of like reverse of what you just asked me. But I think it's, you know, it's good to know that the more research we do in genetics, the more we understand when we find a genetic change, what that can mean. Like, is that a mutation that Dan was talking about earlier? And with that, does this give us information that can help tailor medical treatments and decision making? So a lot of times this information is really critical to know to affect so many areas of life.
When you mentioned disease predisposition, you know, I'm thinking about cancer, but is genetic testing used to look for predisposition to other diseases? Like, can you see if you have a predisposition to diabetes or Alzheimer's?
Yeah, so some conditions are more complex than others. Taking the Alzheimer's example, recently in pop culture in the last few months, Chris Hemsworth, Thor, as many people know him, he did genetic testing through a show that was kind of looking at like health-related risks and everything, and he found out consented to this to be shared publicly that like he is at an increased risk to develop Alzheimer's based on his genetics. So it doesn't mean he will develop it, which is a big concept we're going to talk about today, but that he is a much higher risk than someone else that, you know, doesn't have these mutations that he has, that he inherited in his family. So Alzheimer's is definitely on the list. And there's, you know, other neurodegenerative conditions on there. The list will grow as we go on in the years of understanding this relationship between genetic changes and increasing the risk, because we didn't have this testing decades ago. So genetic testing is really developing very quickly based on the research and the data that we're able to compile.
Excellent. Thanks for breaking that down for us. And you did mention the saliva testing and blood testing. Are there other routes of collecting our DNA for testing?
Yeah, so there's definitely some. That's the most common, I would say, through blood, saliva. In the prenatal space, we can also take a sample of amniotic fluid. So that's the fluid that surrounds the fetus. And so we're able to, in some cases, if we're proceeding with that, take a sample and then actually test those cells. So that's kind of more unique.
Oh, Ms. Deneen, we lost your sound.
No.
There you go. You're back.
I'm back. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, so basically I was just saying that in the prenatal space, it's a little bit specific that we can also look at cells from the amniotic fluid that surrounds the fetus.
Okay, thank you. Well, I've used Myriad Genetics in my medical practice to evaluate patients for gene mutations that lead to increased risk of various cancers, such as looking for the BRCA gene mutation. And personally, I've had the testing through Myriad Genetics and 23andMe as well. And I was surprised to learn that when I got my 23andMe results, they did test for the BRCA gene mutation. So can you tell me more about whether there are any differences in these tests? I had one at Myriad and it was tested through 23andMe. Is there a difference with that information that I received?
Yeah, I can start out. I've also done my own testing through 23andMe, Ancestry, and it is surprising that they look at.
Oh, the sound again. Okay, Mr. Luxick. Oh, we're having a sound problem. Okay, we will get you back, both of you, on the sound. Sometimes that does happen. I do hear somebody, Ms. Deneen.
Maybe that's me.
There you go.
AirPods out, so.
There you go.
Yeah. So in terms of looking at this, when we're doing it through a direct consumer test like 23andMe, they're looking at three common mutations. And they're seeing, are those three mutations not? Now, when we're doing like Myriad Genetics, and we can have Dan expand upon this, since I don't work for Myriad, he knows a little bit more, I would say, than I do on this, that Myriad and other cancer genetic testing companies.
The sound is a little spotty, but what I'm hearing you saying is that when we did the 23andMe, they're looking for three most common genetic mutations, Okay. So what that means, though, is, and I believe in the past you told me about that they're looking for the three most common mutations that would be found in a specific population, like the Ashkenazi Jewish population. And so that may not necessarily be the mutation that you carry, especially if you're not of Ashkenazi Jewish heritage. And so the sequencing that they're doing through other companies, perhaps, you know, more medically relevant companies, one of such would be Myriad, is that they're sequencing. Now, are they sequencing the entire gene to look for those variations? So that's probably the difference. So it's not that the 23andMe was not an accurate test. It just is testing for specific hotspots, I guess. And so maybe the Myriad Genetics is going to just be a more thorough test to have if it's something that you are at risk for and you want to know more about. So how are we doing on our sound for our guests? Okay, we are going to fix the sound. So why don't we just go ahead and take our first break so that we can get them back, because we want to hear from these experts. You are listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. If you have a question or comment for our guest today, give us a call statewide at 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752, or in Anchorage at 907-550-8433. After this short break, we will continue our discussion about genetic testing with Ms. Kira Dineen and Mr. Daniel Luxick as Line 1 continues statewide.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line 1 on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Alaska is growing quickly, so construction jobs are in high demand. 1 in 20 jobs in Alaska are in construction, and with the industry expanding every year, Alaska needs a bigger workforce. The University of Alaska system offers accessible construction management programs, giving students the skills they need to empower Alaska. Learn more at empower.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. I'm joined by genetic counselor Ms. Kira Dineen, who hosts and produces the award-winning podcast DNA Today, a genetics podcast, which is in the top 1% of podcasts globally. Also joining us is Mr. Daniel Luxick, also a genetic counselor and a published writer and researcher in the field of genetics. He is the medical science liaison for Myriad Genetics, a company that specializes in molecular diagnostic testing and precision medicine. Do you have questions about the use of genetic testing in the prenatal space? Do you have questions about the ethical implications of genetic testing? Have you had hereditary cancer screening before? Call us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752, in Anchorage at 907-550-8433, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Okay, so I think we are having some sound difficulties. We do have our guests from out of state, so we're so happy that we could reach out and get experts. But I think we have at least Mr. Luxick, I think we have him back. And Ms. Dineen, too. Okay, great. So yeah. We were talking about the differences between some of the ancestry testing giving us genetic cancer results.
Yeah, so I think one of the things that we were talking about was how the difference between some companies and then a lab like Myriad, which would do more of a medically indicated test, is that the times that you want to go with a medical test, like something that Myriad would offer or one of our other companies, is that that's for somebody who has a real specific indication that's written out by some of the professional societies that sort of make the rules about who should get kind of testing like this and when. So for the most part, the way that we decide whether or not somebody should get this kind of testing is based on either a personal diagnosis of cancer or a family history of cancer. Now, when we're talking about a family history of cancer, it's pretty much common that almost everybody has some cancer in their family history. But for the most part, what we're looking at are an unusual type, so cancers that are multiple, young, or rare. And when we say young for cancer, we're pretty much talking under the age of 50. And in fact, having a single aunt with breast cancer that was diagnosed before the age of 50 is actually the most common reason why people get hereditary cancer testing with my company. So that sort of is how we kind of separate people into those who are at an increased risk for having a genetic mutation that can give them a risk of cancer. The idea here is that, like I said, that we have different genes that do different jobs in our bodies, and some of those jobs are just protecting us against cancer. So if you're born with a problem in one of those genes, you stand a much higher risk of getting certain types of cancer. And so that's what we're really trying to do when we're talking about hereditary cancer testing. We're trying to identify those individuals who are at higher risk.
What are a few of the specific gene mutations that are commonly associated with hereditary cancer, hereditary forms of cancer?
Yeah, so I think we've mentioned the BRCA1 and 2 gene already. Those are probably some of the most common ones. They're the most well-known, I believe, and they're also some of the most dangerous types in that if you have a mutation in the BRCA1 gene, you have a really high risk of getting certain types of cancer. Now, specifically, if we want to use the BRCA1 gene as an example, the types of cancer that you're at an increased risk if you have a mutation in that gene is breast and ovarian cancer. That's actually where the name comes from. BRCA actually stands for breast cancer. There's also a slightly increased risk of other types of cancer, like pancreatic cancer or melanoma, or even men who carry these mutations can be an increased risk of prostate cancer as well. So there's kind of a lot of different types of risks that somebody would face. And just as a reminder, there's lots of different genes that can cause hereditary cancer risks. Some of them don't have anything to do with breast cancer. Some of them do, but they have a much lower risk. Some of them only affect men. Some of them only affect women. So there's lots of different types, and there's lots of different ways that you might go about getting testing for them and the different kind of treatments that you would have if you were to have a mutation that was found.
And who would decide which hereditary cancer to be tested for, which gene to be tested?
Yeah, so we've known about this testing for about 20-some-odd years now, and there's a pretty well-agreed-upon list of genes that you should have in certain situations. So if, for example, you had a family history of breast cancer, definitely getting the BRCA1 and 2 genes analyzed would be a good idea. For a few years now, there's a small handful of other genes that would definitely go along with that, ones that are fairly common that also carry a risk of breast cancer. But different labs offer different tests that can cover different types of cancer. So for the most part, a family history of breast cancer would result in, you know, one of several different gene panels that would cover those. At my company, we offer a set of genes to all patients that any mutation found in one of these genes is going to have management guidelines that are clear, that would apply to all patients, that are definitely actionable. These are fairly well agreed upon, but we are learning more about them every day. Sometimes we take genes off of the panel for ones that we sequence, and sometimes we add other ones on as our understanding of how these work kind of evolves.
Are you only testing for things where there are actionable steps that can be taken?
Yeah, that's one of the things that sort of underlies the importance of hereditary cancer testing, is that maybe in the example of Mr. Hemsworth and his risk of Alzheimer's, there certainly are some things that you can do to reduce the impact of Alzheimer's. But for hereditary cancer, the urgency of getting this kind of testing is fairly high, because when we know about a patient's risk of getting cancer, we can really do something about it in almost every case. So if, for example, we had a patient who was found to have a BRCA1 mutation, there's different imaging that could be done to reduce the risk of breast cancer. There are surgical options that could be done, and there are even medical interventions that we could take, like even, for example, taking oral contraceptive pills for a few years in a row
can significantly reduce the risk of getting ovarian cancer. So for almost all types of cancer and all the genes that we look for, there are things that a doctor can do to manage that patient differently to help reduce their risk of getting sick of or dying of that cancer.
Right. And I think it's just important to, you know, reiterate that you're giving a test that may tell you that you have an increased risk, but it is not saying that you are going to have this sort of cancer. So I think that's kind of scary for people, but the reason to know that information is to use that information for power, just like you talked about risk reduction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Everyone has a risk of getting cancer. All of us in America these days have something around a 30% risk of getting cancer. That risk is kind of slowly ticking up as we go on. And just learning more specifics about what your specific risks are can really help you empower yourself and your medical team to, you know, protect you against those risks.
What if you have an extensive family history of pancreatic cancer or another cancer, but pancreatic cancer, for example, and you tested negative for some of the genetic mutations 10 years ago? Is there a reason to retest?
Yeah. So depending on which type of cancer you're talking about, there have been new genes that we've added. So, for example, it could have been that 10 years ago, you tested negative for the genes that we know that have an association with pancreatic cancer. In the time since that happened, it could have been that we discovered newer genes and you might benefit from additional testing. So that's really dependent on what specific indication and family history you have and what's changed. But there definitely has been a lot that's changed over the last 10 years. And like I said, the information is always evolving. So it would be a pretty specific to what your family history was and exactly when you had what kind of testing.
And do your genes
change?
And
I can add on there that another aspect, as well as additional genes being added, is the variants that could come up. So the spelling differences of the gene. It could be 10 years ago we said, well, we think this is fine and it doesn't lead to an increased risk of cancer. But now maybe we have more evidence that that is fine or maybe is not fine and is categorized as mutation or what we call a pathogenic variant. So I think that's the other aspect that when I was meeting with patients and having them redo their testing years later for cancer indications, that was another reason to do it, kind of like a twofold approach.
And does it have anything to do with on the results seeing that there are variants? Sometimes there are variants that they see of unknown significance, where at that point it may be, I guess, different than the majority, but not necessarily something that's associated with something abnormal. So how often are they learning of these variants? Are they learning that they are, in fact, normal or that they're associated with disease?
Yeah, exactly. So kind of going back to what Kira was saying, sometimes when we do an analysis of a patient's genes, we find a change, but we don't know if it's a harmful change or not. So those would be called a variant of uncertain significance. It's basically like, a difference, but we don't know if it's causing a problem. And it could be that at one point in the past, we can see that change, and at a later point in the future, we can decide whether or not it is harmful or if it is actually benign and something they don't have to worry about. That's a really challenging part about genetics. It's part of the uncertainty of it. And it's something that my company takes a pretty keen look at. We've been looking at a lot of these variants for a number of years. And we actually have a policy of keeping track of every patient's variants that we've ever seen and proactively reaching out to the provider who ordered the test if we ever decide that one of those variants actually is causing a problem and would warrant additional screening. So that is something that we try to do proactively. Of course, you know, sometimes patients move around. But ultimately, if you do ever find that you have one of these variants of uncertain significance, you can usually contact the laboratory that ran that test and ask them every several years if there has been a change to that classification. Because like I said before, our understanding of genetics is always changing.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, talk to me about hereditary cancer protection genes. That's something that's pretty interesting. What happens if there's a mutation in this gene?
Yeah. So like I said, you know, different genes can have different risks of cancer. It sort of just depends on where they are. We do know now that there are a little bit more complicated situations sometimes than having one single gene with one single change that can be damaging. Right now, we're actually looking at something called a polygenic risk score, which is when we're looking at a woman's risk of getting breast cancer. We're not just looking at a few very dramatic genes like the BRCA1 and 2 gene, but we're also looking at dozens of other little markers in the genetics that can associate with a higher or lower risk. And so some of those can be protective. We can actually decide based on a woman's genetics if she's at a little bit less of a risk of getting breast cancer than she otherwise would have appeared to be based on her family history or her medical history.
Wow, very interesting. Okay. We have an email that came in with a question I'd like to ask you. This is from Larry, and they would like to know if there are people who are genetically predisposed to odd drug reactions. They have a friend who has a hypersensitivity to anesthesia. They're hard to wake up after surgery. And also they feel dizzy and they have an upset stomach, as people sometimes do after anesthesia. So they want to know if there's a genetic test that could shed some light on whether you have anesthesia reactions.
I don't know specifically if that's on the list, but I do know this concept exists that I mentioned at the top of the show called pharmacogenomics or pharmacogenetics that studies genes that are related to and can predispose someone to being either sensitive or not sensitive to a drug and different dosages of that. So not my area, but I find it really fascinating. So I've just, you know, done some reading and listening to some podcasts and interviewing some people, but I wouldn't be surprised if that was included on the list, because that is something that is somewhat common that can come up. But that's a great question. I'm going to have to do some research after the show to learn a little bit more about that specifically.
Right. You know, that's true. My husband is an interventional pain physician, and I know that they are using genetic testing for pain medications so that you're not prescribing things that aren't going to, I guess, properly treat or the patient's not going to have a good reaction to. So to me, it seems like you could use that as well for the same medications that you're using for anesthesia. So yes, we will all be researching that so we can learn more about that. I have another email question. This one is from Marilyn, and she would like to know if either of you could discuss and hopefully there's progress on mitigation in the genetic disposition that causes ataxia telangiectasia in children. Do you have any experience with that?
So I want to say, and I'm making sure, that condition, I think, is on something called carrier screening.
Oh, okay.
So carrier screening, we are looking at, I'm making sure, Dan, is that autosomal recessive? I'm, like, just triple checking before I...
Well, ATM is actually a little bit interesting because, Kira, it is a recessive condition caused by the ataxia telangiectasia caused by the ATM gene. People who only have one copy of it, though carriers of it, are actually at an increased risk of getting cancer as well. So it sort of acts as both of these types of diseases, where it's a hereditary cancer gene and a recessive condition as well.
All right.
That's where Dan and I cross over.
Yes. So when you're talking about a recessive, that means you need a copy of the mutation from both of the parents in order to actually have that disease. All right. So when you talked about carrier screening, I think we'll move into the prenatal space. But with the carrier screening, you're testing people before they're pregnant to see if they carry one of those genes. So that can make a difference in something like a recessive disease, where you would not only, we both need to have this, the mother and the father would both need to have
right
a mutation.
So both biological,
yes, both of you.
And in an ideal world, mm-hmm. we would definitely do this preconception, so mm-hmm. before someone starts trying to conceive, before they're pregnant. But realistically, most people end up doing this in the first trimester of their pregnancy, or if they weren't offered it previously, their current pregnancy. If I could hit a button, I would have everybody be offered this in their GYN appointment. Once they either reach a certain age, or people can ask, like, are you planning on having biological children? Is that something that you would think about? so that we could learn about this prior to pregnancy, because, you know, I've heard a statistic that about half of all pregnancies are not planned. So it's good to have this information ahead of time, because then you have more options if you want to go ahead and do something called IVF and have fertility treatments, where you can look at the embryos ahead of time and look to see, will this inherit that condition or not, and can choose those embryos that will not inherit the condition. So, you know, that's kind of a lot of information in one go, but there are a lot of options. So it's definitely best to do before you're pregnant, but you're with everybody else, really, if you're doing it during pregnancy.
Hey, absolutely. I have another email, and this one is about cost. They want to know, what kinds of costs are associated with genetic testing? Is this covered by insurance, and particularly Medicaid? Oh, Mr. Luxick? I don't hear them.
Dan?
Oh, there you are, Ms.
No.
I hear you,
okay,
Ms. Deneen.
Okay, so I can answer until we get Dan. It really depends on the type of testing we're talking about in terms of cost. So for things in the prenatal space, most of the time we're talking about a couple hundred dollars. And if we're talking about, sorry, we're trying to get Dan back on. So if we're talking about the prenatal test, care screening is usually a couple hundred. And if we are looking at cancer testing, like the testing that Dan is involved with, Myriad and other companies like that, also a couple hundred, sometimes it's even zero, because a lot of times insurance companies will cover it. So that's part of it. But for a lot of the genetic testing, we're looking at a couple hundred there. Dan, I'm not sure if we have you back, but anything else to add to that if you are here?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, for different types of testing, different people's insurance would cover it differently. Probably some of the best insurance coverage is for people who meet those family history criteria, like I was saying, for the hereditary cancer. And that's kind of a testament to how useful this testing is from a cost-benefit analysis, at least as far as the insurance companies see it. I would say that, generally speaking, all genetic testing has gotten a lot less expensive than it was in the past, but it will kind of depend person to person what kind of coverage they have and what kind of costs they do have. A lot of labs will let patients know before the test is completed how much their expected out-of-pocket is, and some will even offer some financial assistance programs for people. So there's a lot more flexibility than there used to be.
And I've seen the cost going down less and less and less. And yes, I have noticed that the insurance coverage has been getting better and better. And not only that, is that some of the testing companies also have help for people who maybe don't have insurance and don't have any other coverage for it. So with these advancements in science come decrease in costs, which is interesting. That doesn't always happen, but in this situation it has. And I think with that cost-benefit analysis, that makes sense. I did have one more cancer question, and it's about the National Comprehensive Cancer Network that sets the you know, evidence-based guidelines for cancer diagnosis and treatment. I've noticed that they say that for several different types of cancer, a complete workup would include germline testing, so a specific type of genetic testing in patients that are diagnosed with cancer. Is this something that is now commonplace to have for patients who are diagnosed with cancer, or should it be?
Yeah, I would say that it's becoming much more commonplace. The National Comprehensive Cancer Network just recently changed their guidelines to be a little bit more supportive of, for example, people with colon cancer, to going right towards doing genetic testing on that, rather than jumping through a few other hoops that they used to, where they would look for certain markers on the tumor before they did that. It's something that, you know, definitely is becoming more common. It's by no means universal, but you mentioned an interesting concept of tumor testing versus what we would call germline genetic testing. So obviously any tumor or cancer that you have, that tumor itself is going to have genetics that's kind of changed from how your normal body works. That's what makes it a tumor. But we can also think about a patient's germline or the rest of their body's genetics, the stuff that they were born with. So I would say that it's very common, most likely, for a new diagnosis of cancer to have a tumor test, and it's becoming more common for those patients to also have germline testing. So one is mostly applicable just to the patient and the type of cancer that they have and what treatments might be beneficial to them there. And then the germline testing would also be beneficial to them for knowing their recurrence risk, but also their family members would know that they may have been born with that same change too, that might also put them at an increased risk of cancer.
So both for targeted treatment and for a risk reduction as well. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, when we know that somebody has a germline mutation that caused their cancer, so for example, if a patient who has breast cancer is found to not have a mutation in something like BRCA1, we might just look at their breast cancer and consider that by itself. But if we knew that they had a BRCA1 mutation, we would also know that they had a much higher risk of recurrence, and we'd also know about those other organs, like the ovaries or the pancreas, but now we also know that there's a risk there too. So there's a lot of benefits to getting as big of a picture as we can about the genetic situation of the patient and their disease.
Okay. Well, taking this now into the prenatal space, because that is also going to be about predisposition and treatments, testing for disease. So how is genetic testing being used in preconception and prenatal? And you mentioned some of it already.
So I think that one of the ways that we can use this in the prenatal space is to screen for some diseases that might be present during a pregnancy. And if we know about those diseases, there are sometimes interventions that we can take. There's sometimes birth plans that can be adjusted. And there's sometimes that there's choices that patients can make, like Kira mentioned, IVF, which can sometimes help us conceive a pregnancy that wouldn't be affected with that genetic condition.
Okay, and we have a lot more to unveil about this, but we do have to take one last break and then we're gonna get more into this. So if you have a question or a comment for our guest today, give us a call statewide at 1-888-353-5752 or in Anchorage at 907-550-8433. We'll continue our discussion on genetic testing when we return. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line 1 on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Alaska is growing quickly, so construction jobs are in high demand. 1 in 20 jobs in Alaska are in construction, and with the industry expanding every year, Alaska needs a bigger workforce. The University of Alaska system offers accessible construction management programs, giving students the skills they need to empower Alaska. Learn more at empower.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
Welcome back to Line One. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. Our guests today are licensed genetics counselor, Mr. Daniel Luxig, and Ms. Kira Dineen. Both have a Master's of Science in Human Genetics degree from Sarah Lawrence College in New York. You can also join our conversation. Do you have a question for our genetic testing experts today? Call us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752, in Anchorage at 907-550-8433, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Okay, so we were talking about the prenatal space and talking about how this is used for carrier screening and IVF. And did you have anything else you wanted to add to that, Ms. Dineen? Nope. I see her. So I am with them on Zoom, and I can see their wonderful faces and that they're talking. But today is not our day for the sound. Yes. So while we get you back, I do have a question about You know, many pregnant patients may shy away from genetic testing because they feel that they wouldn't terminate a pregnancy with a known genetic mutation. So I would like for you to talk to us about how genetic testing is still important. And in my opinion, I think it may be even more important to have this information for a pregnancy that will be carried to term. Ms. Deneen.
Yeah. Am I back?
I can hear you now.
Amazing. So, yeah, I think it's important information because it is information that someone may receive and say, you know what, I don't know if I do want to carry this pregnancy to term. However, it's also valuable information because it could change, as Dan was alluding to earlier, it could change birth plans. We can also take time during pregnancy to prepare to have a child with this condition and raise them and parent them. So if that's something like maybe we've learned that there's a chance that baby could be deaf or have severe hearing loss, we might do what I referred to earlier as taking a little bit of the amniotic fluid and testing that to see, okay, did baby inherit this? Did baby not inherit this? And if baby did inherit, let's say, deafness, then maybe the parents start learning sign language during pregnancy. They could start identifying people in the community and start really learning about deaf culture. So I think there's a lot to be said for information being power. And it's certainly a decision on the pregnant person's side, their partner, their family, whether they want this information and going through with that, which is what makes me and Dan's role really important of explaining to people the options that they have and reasons to do testing, reasons not to do testing. And to basically be their guidance counselor of genetic testing to say, okay, here's your options. Like, what's going to work best for your family? Every patient and family that comes into my office does not do the same thing. Otherwise, I wouldn't be needed in this role. So being able to figure out what's going to work best for them, and sometimes that information can be helpful during pregnancy, even when maybe termination is not on the table for them. So there's a lot of reasons to do it, a lot of reasons not to do it, and it's really helpful to talk to a healthcare provider that's trained in genetics to figure out what the best situation is for them.
I love that. For preparing, I like how you said you could prepare yourself and prepare. And also, if it's a issue, if they had a cardiac issue or something where they're going to need specialized services after delivery, but then you'll have the ability to get yourself to a place where they're able to deliver the care that your baby would need. So how accurate are these genetic tests? Because you mentioned the amniotic testing, but now we have non-invasive prenatal testing where they can just draw the mother's blood. How accurate is that test?
Yeah, so there's a big difference, as we've talked about today, between screening and testing. So screening is looking to see, are there high risk levels or chance levels or low risk and chance levels? Whereas testing is saying, okay, in the pregnancy space, baby either has this condition or does not have this condition. It's a yes or no answer versus high or low chance. So that's the main difference between them. When it comes to non-invasive prenatal screening, also known as NIPS, that is a really good screening test. So if you do the screening and it comes back normal, the chance the test missed some of those main conditions like Down syndrome, these are random conditions, so the chance the test missed that is 1 in 10,000. That's way less than a percent. So the way I interpret that, and everybody's going to interpret it differently, but the way I interpret that is this is a really good screening test. If everything comes back normal, you have less than 1% chance that we've missed one of these conditions.
Excellent. How is cell-free DNA being used in the prenatal space? We didn't get to talk about that in the cancer space, but that's pretty exciting in that world too. How are we using that in prenatal?
Sure. So that's the technology behind the non-invasive prenatal screening. So naturally, pregnant people have DNA coming off of their placenta and floating in their bloodstream. So it is a natural phenomenon that cells in our body pop open and release their DNA. So that's what's referred to as cell-free DNA. And during pregnancy, we can pick up on that DNA and say, okay, we're looking for extra missing chromosome conditions like Down syndrome, also looking at the sex chromosomes to see if anything is different there that could pick up conditions called Turner syndrome or Klinefelter syndrome. And because of doing that, we can also find out sex of baby if that's something that the parents want to know. So it's a really cool technology that we can use in this space, And there have been cases where people are pregnant, and because we're looking at the cell-free DNA, we may be able to pick up that they also may have cancer at the same time. So that's something that, you know, I mentioned to patients that we could learn health information about them. And, you know, if they want to get more details into that, I do. That is rare to happen, but it can happen because we're using very similar technology there.
Are you looking for cancer cells in the patient or in the fetus?
It would more be coming up from the person that's pregnant, not the fetus, because we're looking at DNA that's just floating in their bloodstream, and cancer cells do the same thing. So cancer cells also are popping open and releasing their DNA. So with the data, if we're seeing that there's a lot of extra chromosomes or a lot of missing chromosomes, we're like, that wouldn't make sense for this to still be a viable pregnancy that's 10 weeks and counting. So at that point, we'd say, well, is there something else going on here?
That's so interesting. I didn't know that that was happening. Now, is this the same as the liquid biopsy? I have been seeing companies that are offering cancer testing to diagnose, I guess, diagnose cancer in these very early stages through genetic testing.
Yeah, it's definitely the same principle. So as Kira said, when anything is growing, it's sometimes releasing some of its own DNA, and cancers and tumors are no exception. There are currently, I think, one company that has a product that can look for very, very early stages of cancer. There are several companies now who are offering products where once you have had cancer, they can monitor for a recurrence of it, all based off of this cell-free DNA. So there's kind of a lot of very exciting possibilities here. This is a part of the field of genetics that's rapidly changing. There's a lot of new innovations, new products, and new companies getting involved here. my company itself is involved in some of these things, and it's a very interesting time for the world of cancer prevention, recurrence monitoring, screening. I think in maybe 5 or 10 years from now, the way that we look for cancer and measure its response to treatment is going to be very different. And it's just one of the cool ways that, you know, genetics is changing so much and there's so many things we can do with it. We really are kind of living in a golden age of this genetic technology.
Oh, that's absolutely right. Like, I can only imagine how this is going to transform healthcare and treatment. And can you imagine doing a blood test and knowing if you have early stages of a cancer and how much better your treatment and outcomes will be when you're starting from these early stages? So I'm excited to be along. I don't know, we may be out of some jobs here because we won't be doing some of our screening tests anymore, but that is wonderful. I love hearing that. Well, I am not embarrassed to admit that for many people my age and older, our first introduction to DNA and genetics was through the Mari Povich show, you know, where they did paternity testing and they either announced you are the father or you are not the father. So that's where my genetic testing started from. So to go from there to where we are now is amazing. But have we had any advances in paternity testing? Can we test people during pregnancy to learn paternity?
Yeah, so this is a very exciting area, and I got to geek out. I actually got to interview Mari Povich a couple months ago on DNA Today, so that was very exciting.
Wow.
We got to record in the NBC studio, and he is just such a nice guy, I have to say. And it's interesting because when I started my role here in prenatal genetics, I wasn't sure the answer to that. So I kind of had to do a little bit of research, and I wasn't sure, do we have to wait till baby's born to do paternity testing? But we can actually do it during pregnancy. So there is, you know, there's a well-known lab that Mari Povich actually orders from, and they are known for being able to provide this information where we can get a blood sample from the pregnant person and do a cheek swab for who we think the biological father could be. Or maybe there's two people, so we can do testing for that and look to see, you know, if that's the case. Like, you know, and as you said, Maury's catchphrase, you are the father, you're not the father. So, you know, having that information. But yes, we can do that during pregnancy. It can be pricey, but it is available.
Wow. So you don't necessarily have to have the amniocentesis, like a more invasive test to do this. Wow. And then we didn't
talk about... I'm sure it used to be like that.
Yes.
Where you'd have to do an amniocentesis, but mm-hmm. with the advent of this cell-free DNA, now we're able to do testing like this. So I imagine 10 plus years ago, we were not able to do that, but that's a little before my time in the field.
I'm surprised you know him. So.
Yeah, it was cool to be able to talk with him.
Yes. Now, going back to amniocentesis, and we didn't mention the chorionic villus sampling, so more invasive testing that we're doing. Perhaps in the past, they were doing screening tests non-invasively through blood, and then if there was an increased risk, they were going on to doing these more invasive tests during pregnancy. Is that still the pathway? Are we still going on to the invasive tests for confirmation?
Yeah, so in most cases, I am talking with patients, if something has come up that is suspicious or that there's a higher chance for a condition through the screening, then we're talking about, do you want to do one of these invasive procedures, an amniocentesis or chorionic villus sampling, CVS, as you mentioned, to be able to get that yes or no answer. And if that's the path that they want to go down, we're looking between those two tests. One of the main differences between them is the CVS, we're basically taking a biopsy of the placenta. In the vast majority of cases in pregnancy, the placental DNA is the same as the fetus's DNA. Where there are some exceptions to that, and depending on the condition, we may say, you know, we could end up having a difference in DNA there, so it makes sense to go and get a more direct sample through the amniocentesis. What is advantageous about a CVS is it can be done earlier in pregnancy. So we can do this at the end of the first trimester, whereas an amniocentesis typically is recommended at 15, 16 weeks or later, you know, just to reduce the risk of a miscarriage happening, which is a consideration when you're doing these procedures, that is a risk that you are taking. It is a very small risk, but it is still a risk.
I see. And how early in pregnancy can these non-invasive tests be performed?
So typically 9 or 10 weeks is when labs will accept a sample. So you're still in the first trimester, so that's only a couple months into your pregnancy, and we're able to take a traditional blood draw. So that is a peripheral blood sample, so we're not doing anything invasive, hence the name non-invasive. And so, yeah, usually around 9, 10 weeks.
Okay. Well, we have run out of time. We've talked about a lot today. Let me give you a few moments to share any final thoughts that you have with us. Ms. Deneen.
Okay, yeah, sure. So, yeah, I think it's important for people to remember that genetics is complicated and that, you know, we're really looking at risk levels sometimes, and sometimes we're looking at a diagnosis. And I think understanding that there is that difference there is very helpful. Looking at genetic testing, it can be advantageous for yourself to learn, but also it can be really helpful to family members. I know we mentioned that, but just to really bring that point home, sometimes the reason people are doing genetic testing is that so they have that information to pass along to their children, to their siblings, nieces, nephews, you know, whoever in the family. But yeah, I think we've covered quite a lot in an hour. I mean, there's so much to talk about, which is why I have a weekly genetics podcast. So if people want to learn more, they can search DNA Today on their podcast app.
Thank you to you both, Ms. Kira Deneen and Mr. Daniel Luxick, for being with us today. Thanks to our audio engineer, Chris Hyde, and our producer, Madeline Rose. You can find more information on this and previous programs on our website at alaskapublic.org. Let us know your thoughts or suggestions by emailing us at line1@alaskapublic.org. This has been Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. Thank you.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants, and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.